a young King Arthur, upon meeting Guinevere, not revealing himself to be the young King Arthur in the play Camelot, proclaims, "It's true. It's true. The crown has made it clear. The climate must be perfect all the year. A law was made a distant moon ago here. July and August cannot be too hot. And there's a legal limit to the snow here in Camelot. The winter is forbidden till after December, and exits March the 2nd on the dot. By order, summer lingers through September in Camelot. Camelot, Camelot, I know it sounds a bit bizarre, but in Camelot, Camelot, that's how conditions are. The rain must never fall till after sundown. By 8, the morning fog must disappear. In short, there's simply not a more congenial spot for happy ever aftering than here in Camelot." We recognize Camelot as a myth, as a place that never was. The play itself by Lerner and Lowe, taken from an ancient myth, the Mort d'Arthur, and other sources, are clearly mythic in their presentation. We are supposed to only partially suspend disbelief and laugh at the irony of such regularity in a British calendar year of weather. Nobody believed that, even in the 50s and 60s. It was a myth, and we knew it was a myth. Much as we knew that the Greek myths were stories about gods and their powers, their perfections, their frailties, their human failings, and that it was all much more complicated and much deeper than the facade of iconic myth that we placed even at the time of the Kennedy administration, we knew that we were taking people and building them up and building the atmosphere up and seeing John F. Kennedy as a young Arthur, bringing together his Knights of the Round Table, the best and the brightest. And in our youth, we figured, well, what could go wrong with the best and the brightest? And this young president who did embody the hopes of a new generation. This was a president of a different color of hair and physique from Roosevelt, 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 Truman, Eisenhower. Here was somebody that talked about youthful vigor. And when he talked about vigor, we believed him. And we felt, it's our turn. We have this strength, this idealism, this belief that we can bend the world to our will, that we can do something special. In a way, when we look back on this, this is an iteration of American exceptionalism that my generation for a moment bought into, and we felt empowered. What Kennedy did that was really inspirational is embodied in a couple of lines. One, the torch has been passed to a new generation, and we said, yep, we'll take it. It was before even Dylan could say, you're sons and your daughters are beyond your control. Your old road is rapidly aging. Get out of our new one if you can't lend a hand, because the times, they are a-changing. We were part of that change. The other thing that Kennedy did in his rhetoric, and it's useful to look at George W.'s speech after 9/11, which was half a good speech, but what Kennedy did was not to say, America will be great if you keep shopping. What Kennedy did was he offered challenges and called for sacrifice. That's what was missing from Bush's talk. What he said was not bad. What he didn't say was important. Kennedy challenged my generation to do something, not to be spectators. A lot of pundits and social commentary people were saying, the generation of the 60s is going to be passive because this is the first generation brought up on television, and therefore they will never get out of their chairs or off their couches and be involved in life. Well, Kennedy summoned us away from our couches, and some people who came later wished that we had stayed and let the government do what it wanted to do. But we were called to sacrifice. We were called to ask not what our country could do for us, but what we could do for our country. Kennedy challenged us with the moon program, saying, we're going to the moon not because it's easy, but because it's hard. There is nothing that summons passion and involvement as much as it is as the demand to do something, to sacrifice something, to be a part of something greater than just yourself. Created the Peace Corps. Many responded and said yes and went into the Peace Corps. Raise your hands, RPCVs here. 1, 2, 3. Any more? It's not too late. You can do it again at almost any age. And I'm thinking about it, although Tunisia does not have a program right now. Many of us responded because we believed in what was essentially a liberal, if sometimes naive, notion that to know us is simply to love us. So that if we went abroad to these other countries, whatever we did, whatever we taught, they would get to know us and we would not simply be the caricatures that were thrown about in whatever press these countries had. That our kids, mostly whom we taught, and our teachers that we taught with, would not be able to say, oh, Americans are this. They'd have to say, you know, I worked with a bunch of Americans, and, you know, they were almost human. They were pretty good. They're not as the caricatures portray them. And we, when we came back, could no longer just point at those them and believe that they were the caricatures that they were sometimes portrayed as being. This was a time when we believed that cultural exchange, that information, that experience could create the conditions for peace. This is before ping-pong diplomacy, but it's after American Life magazine was translated into Russian and sent to the Soviet Union, and that Soviet Life was distributed here. It was when we were interviewing athletes and ballets, and there were the beginnings of cultural exchanges. And we believed deeply that the knowledge of each other would humanize each other and help us get beyond the stereotypes. Kennedy's call, and I joined the Peace Corps after he was assassinated, but it was a call that brought people together in service, in a sense of optimism, in a sense that we had a destiny to fulfill, but it would not write itself. We would have to be part of the future. We would have to be some of the change that we believed in. We were challenged, and although it's not his phrase, by his iteration of the fierce urgency of now. It was an exciting time. We understood at some level that we were dealing in a mythic structure. We understood that it was probably not a play that is going on where these perfect people were having wonderful conversations behind the scenes and that it really was Camelot. We understood that progress was happening, but it was slow. We understood, even at the time of the abortive invasion of Cuba, the Bay of Pigs fiasco, that the White House was not occupied by a pacifist. We understood that the Cold War was very much a part of the governing ideology of even liberals at that time. We understood all of those things, and yet there was an optimism that we could heal ourselves and be worthy of the power that we held, that we could make intelligent and compassionate decisions. We didn't believe the myth, just as I never believed the myths of Zeus and Jupiter and Saturn and Hermes and Mercury and Poseidon, but we were informed by it. We took them not even seriously, but we let them play on us like music. And there was a sense of American exceptionalism, and it was shattered on November 22nd, 1963, when this young and vigorous president was struck down and killed. And it pierced so much more than one skull and ending one life. It taught us in the moment that we were not invulnerable. It instructed us that our sense of exceptionalism had to at least be held up to question. Because when we thought, we don't do this, we don't kill our presidents, there had not been a president assassinated since 1901 and William McKinley. For our generation, that might as well have been Julius Caesar or Pericles, because 1901 was in the infinite mists of the past. Kennedy's death, in a lot of ways, and everybody here knows where you were, and if we didn't have a congregational meeting and we're going to have a talk back, we could do an hour of just where we were. But since I'm up here, I'm telling you where I was. I was in a philosophy class being introduced to Thales, arguably the first really lost philosopher in the West. And I came out, I went to USC, and I'm walking past the plaza, and there's a TV truck by Tommy Trojan, and I'm figuring it's there because the UCLA-SC game is going to be that Saturday. But I'm hearing a buzz. The president's been shot. The president's been shot. Johnson's been shot. Oh, my God. All of the rumors that were going around. My first reaction was denial. Oh, we had killed Castro a dozen times, and this is 1963. Castro had been assassinated by his people, by the CIA. He had died 1,000 deaths in our media. So my first reaction was denial. This is a rumor. This is wild. This is crazy. And I stuck my head in the TV truck and heard Walter Cronkite take off his glasses, look at the clock, and announce that the president was dead. I walked to the grassy median where we had our flagpole, and I lowered our flag at USC to half staff, and then went to class in a daze because it couldn't really have been happening. A single or two bullets, magical or not magical, from this most unlikely of suspects to bring down this young and vigorous man, to bring down, crashing about us, a sense of invulnerability and of hope just didn't seem possible. Even in the first 24, 48 hours before Oswald himself was killed by mob-connected Jack Ruby, you couldn't write this as fiction, because it was, we were looking around saying, so, Texas, they found the only communist in Texas? This was just, everybody's going, now, if you're going to get assassinated in Texas, Lee Harvey, is he your guy? you understand why conspiracy theories happened. And the truth of them or the non-truth of them is not what this talk is about. I don't believe that we know the facts. We know that information was withheld from the Warren Commission. We know that evidence was locked up, hidden, and destroyed. So there's very little reason to believe any one particular thing. But what we can know and examine is the condition of our own souls when this act began a new relationship that my generation had with our nation and with our government. It is the beginning of skepticism, the beginning of a sense really almost of betrayal. We re-examined, whether consciously or not, our relationship to America and what America meant. I argue, and I'm now quoting myself just so I'm not accused of plagiarizing, which I could be if I didn't quote the fact that I said this before. You can legally plagiarize yourself, and it is a journalistic sin, so that's why I'm disclosing this. But I wrote an essay a number of years ago called The 17-Year Decade. And my argument was that what we call the 60s did not begin on January 1st, 1960, or technically 1961 for the math freaks here. For me, the 60s began November 22nd, 1963, with the death of John F. Kennedy. And the coming of age and the losing of innocence culminated on December 1, 1981, with the death of John Lennon. Those are the two bookends of a journey of maturity, of exploration, of immaturity, of wandering, and of wondering that so influenced my particular, well, myself and my cohort. The 60s were a time that would have been, I suspect, very different had Kennedy lived. We were indeed not spectators. Some of us stayed in our Peace Corps visions. Many of us that came out of the Peace Corps went into helping professions of teaching, of social work, of clergy, of charitable work. We got, as a nation, our money's worth, and I think most of the nations that hosted us got something of value from us. But it was also a time when we were not going to be spectators to the great issues that roiled the social waters, the issues of civil rights for African American people, which is to say civil rights for people, civil rights for women, which is to say civil rights for people. Our generation was going to ask questions. And when inspired to go to any place, to bear any burden, and to do it not because it's easy, but because it's hard, this is the law of unintended consequences. We got off of our couches, and we got into the streets. And we examined ourselves and our country and the DNA of our society and said, there are things that need to be changed, and it won't be easy. And sometimes we sat down, sometimes we shrank, sometimes we overreacted, but we were involved, and I think a lot of it came from that call, from that summons to be involved in the fate of this nation, that it might be a more goodly nation because we lived, because we cared. Over the years, the misty fogs of Avalon and of Camelot have disappeared, and we have seen the Kennedy administration and the Kennedy family for what they were, much as the Greek gods, jealous, frail, in moral centeredness. There's a great line in a Sondheim show, Into the Woods, where Prince Charming, who has been caught with somebody other than Cinderella, says, "I'm Prince Charming, not Prince Faithful." Well, there's a song for the Kennedy years. The scales have slowly fallen from our eyes, and there have been all of those books and books and TV programs over the last couple of weeks talking about the reality of it. Well, we'll never know the full reality past some of the myth, but we do know that our leaders are for the most part human beings with all of the frailties, all of the ego, all of the power needs, all of the mendacity that we have come to expect. And over the period of time, we have lost not our idealism, I hope, but we have lost our innocence. And that's okay. That's okay to look at even the most, or maybe particularly, the most inspiring charismatic leaders, because they're the people that can take you the farthest without our examining what is going on. We came very close to nuclear annihilation with the Cuban Missile Crisis. We blundered into it, and we kind of blundered out of it, and the price that we paid, we don't talk about very much, because we talk about Khrushchev blinking. We don't talk about we pulled our missiles from Turkey. There was an exchange. It was the right thing to do, but we don't teach our history, even our revisionist history, very well in most places, except in Paul's classes. There's one exception to that. So when I see the Kennedy material, I think of Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who said, and I think said accurately for my generation, "We will laugh again, but we'll never be young again." There was an energy, there was a hope. There's energy and hope in a new generation. It was kindled again some years ago. And it too undergoes the attack of reality as we try to put human beings and human institutions in context. And there are days that maybe we don't feel as young as we once did, and that's true of people of every age. But I think of the end of Camelot, when the weary, not broken, but weary King Arthur comes forward again and in a completely different tone redoes part of Camelot. Each evening from December to December, before you drift to sleep upon your cot, think back on all the tales that you remember from Camelot. Ask every person if he's heard the story, and tell it strong and clear if he has not, that once there was a fleeting wisp of glory called Camelot, where once it never rained till after sundown. By 8 a.m., the morning fog had flown. Don't let it be forgot that once there was a spot for one brief shining moment that was known as Camelot. A nice story.